downloading the Missouri Review Sound Booth podcast. We're broadcasting from the University of Missouri campus in Columbia, Missouri, home of the Missouri Review, the quarterly that brings you the best contemporary literature in fiction, nonfiction, and poetry. Every week, we'll be featuring a wide range of readings and interviews with writers, editors, and agents. This week on the Missouri Review Sound Booth, we're pleased to bring you a recording of author Karen Russell reading her work at the University of Missouri campus. In this podcast, Russell reads excerpts from her novella, Sleep Donation, and from her short story, Reeling for the Empire. Karen Russell is the author of two short story collections and one novel. Most recently, her novella, Sleep Donation, was released as a digital-only book as Atavist Books' debut title.
I thought I would just read a little bit from this new novella that I wrote called Sleep Donation and a little from a short story. I like to print out and bring many more pages than I'll read to you as an intimidation tactic. So then wherever I choose to stop, you'll feel relieved. It'll seem like the right place. So this is just a tiny bit from the opening of, I call it a novella. It's sort of this story, runaway story, alarms people. And it was just sort of born out of my own desire for a sleep donation. I've had a hard time with insomnia since I was a kid, and it was really acute around the same time last year. And I thought there should be an American Red Cross analog where you could donate dreams to an insomniac. So that's the premise. The sleep band. The siren goes and we code for dispatch. 9 times in 20 lately, it's the same address, 3300 Cedar Ridge Parkway. Then we get a call back saying the dispatch is canceled. Then we get a third call. No, disregard the cancellation. Get a sleep van to the property staff. What's happening is revealed to us by a visibly distraught Jim. Mr. and Mrs. Harkonnen are having a dispute. Mr. Harkonnen says he wants to drop out. So what, says the intern, we don't even use his donations. No, jackass, he is trying to pull out with baby A. Everybody looks over at that. Rudy slaps his bald spot and leaves his hand there. A grapefruit hue spills underneath his finger as if the scalp is blushing. Jim freezes in the center of the trailer, in full view of every staffer, and rubs his fists against his gray eyes. It is a pitiful and futile gesture to witness, like watching a hamster cower inside a plastic cage. We can see how scared Jim is of losing both things, baby A, and our good opinion of him. Six staffers are working the phones tonight, and we are all mentally coaching him. Don't cry, Jim. Our sleep station has an unusual top-heavy hierarchy. We have two supervisors, the Storch brothers. They are former CEOs who left the business world at the height of the insomnia crisis and now freely give all of their resources to the not-for-profit Slumber Corp. Money, time, intellect, leadership, creativity, toilet seats. The Storches made their fortune in the ergonomic toilet business. You may have seen their advertisements. To shit upon a Storch feels better than a visit to your chiropractor. Their extreme altruism is a provocation to everyone on staff, an inducement to work even harder, a reminder that we could all be giving more. Rudy and Jim have been my supervisors for 7 years. I was the first recruiter assigned to their team. I don't socialize with them outside work. Our contact is limited to this office unless you count our public performances at poor fundraisers, the charity balls, and charity golf offs. But I know every shadow of my boss's faces. All of their storchy tics, that upsetting thing that Rudy does with his pen caps, and what Jim's not saying at our meeting. The brothers are middle-aged Irish twins, clean-shaven, and built like longshoremen. Externally, they have slate eyes and cranberry red hair, balding in identical horseshoe patterns. Internally, each brother has his own uniquely fucked emotional metabolism. Rudy, for example, is currently managing his despair by bawling out the interns, sweat drooling all along his dusky face like a July whiskey glass. The Storches are celebrities in the sleep crisis community. 8 years ago, the brothers served together on the inaugural Slumber Corps Board of Directors at headquarters in Washington, D.C. Within months, the Corps had established outposts in every major city, accumulating green offshoots of the D.C. base. Soon, local branches began operating more or less independently, soliciting donations for money and sleep, whereupon the brothers promptly requested a demotion to the slow, prestige placement in their home city, a solar zone. We serve an urban core where the rate of insomnia is 22% higher than the national average. Our Pennsylvania city has one of the greatest REM sleep deficits on the East Coast, although we are certainly not the worst hit. Tampa, riddlingly, currently leads the nation in new cases of insomnia. The governor's budget cuts in that sunshine state have meant that Floridian sleep scientists remain stalled at the dang, go figure, stage of their research. Hundreds of our old neighbors, friends, coworkers, and teachers are new insomniacs. They file for dream bankruptcy, appeal for slumber court aid, wait to be approved for a sleep donor. It is a special kind of homelessness, says our mayor, to be evicted from your dreams. I believe our mayor is both genuinely concerned for his insomniac constituency and also pandering to a powerful new voting bloc. Currently, the NCEH is investigating possible environmental causes in our city, everything from the water table to disturbed eagles' nests, to the brilliance of the moon on grass, to the antique screams of the historic monorail. I grew up here too. We operate out of a Moby office, 6 interlocking trailers dry docked on a vacant downtown lot which the Corps leases from the city. The Redneck Labyrinth, my boss calls it. A former FEMA engineer designed it as a temporary accommodation, a base camp for local teams working at the frontiers of crisis. We've been here for half a decade. Nobody suggests moving into a brick and mortar office. Nobody wants to peer through glass windows in a building with a foundation and admit that the emergency is now a permanent condition. You'd think it would be difficult to hide in a trailer, but I'm chameleon next to the phone wall near the black window. Some intern has made curtains for the trailer windows, snaggy lace, which look nothing like curtains, in fact, but vestments tiny and obscene, bridal veils for mice, chinchilla negligees. They flutter in the trailer's manic air conditioning. Outside, the moon is a colossus. Its radiance makes every white of human manufacture seem dingy, impure. I turn from the moon and remove the headset. I give myself one more blank moment. Where's Trish? Get Trish. Over here, I say. Edgewater, screams Rudy. There you are. We have a major goddamn problem. A hitch, Jim soothes. The mother is solid. She's 100%. The father, though. The father is afflicted with doubts. The father is a selfish prick. Trish, honey, the bastard hung up on us twice. Whose signature is on the consent? Do we have both? Now everyone is staring at me. We do, I say. I have the file here. Edgewater will handle this, Rudy prophesies, staring right at me. Mr. Harkonnen needs to be reminded of why this is important, life or death. Oh, I think he knows, Jim. I already pitched them. Them? Her, I admit, the mother. Aha! But I'm sure she's told him about Dory. But not the way you tell it, Edgewater. Rudy beams at me. Rudy is the kind of boss who goes from screaming to beaming in 2 seconds flat at a psychopathic velocity. He's got to hear it from you, face to face. Only a stone would refuse to donate after your pitch. Trish, baby, Edgewater. Pride heats my eyes. It's reprehensible, but that's what happens. It might not work, I say, if he's that dead set against it. And then Jim and Rudy pour it on even thicker, emphasizing that I am indispensable to the organization, that the Corps would be lost without me, etc., etc. Look at you, Rudy grins. Look at those hands, Jim says approvingly. We look at my hands, which are shaking. I feel proud again, which has got to be the wrong response to a set of involuntary tremors. My body knows what I'm about to do, and it's balking, just like Mr. Harkonnen. Well, you are the genuine article, Trish. Okay. You are simply the I said I'll go, Rudy. Rudy is a bad recruiter. I've seen him in action. Potential donors sway on the brink of a yes, prepared to surrender to the gravity of the appeal, but then Rudy gets overzealous. Rudy turns the solicitation into a game of coercion, until at last his lips smacking anticipation of their gift makes them wary again, and they stiffen into a no. That's how we got baby A, you know, Jim Stage whispers to the intern, Sam Yoon, a college junior in a mint green dress shirt, who is earnestly frowning as I exit the trailer. It's a whisper I know I'm meant to hear. Trish pitched Mrs. Harkonnen at a sleep drive in a parking lot. Nabbed her right outside the grocery store, schlepping baby A. Watch her pitch sometime. Shadow her at a drive. She is just pure appeal, pure passion for the cause. Her sister was Dory Edgewater. Oh my, says the intern, exactly matching Rudy's tone. What distinguishes me as a recruiter, I'm told by my bosses, is that my sister's death is evergreen for me, a pure shock, the freshest outrage. I don't have to dig around with the needle. That vein is open on the surface. And Trish cannot fake it. She cries every time. She quakes like. She gets emotional, and people really respond. Describes the sister like she's standing right in front of her. She sobs like she's still at the wake. Jim frowns, self-startled. He is a mid-sentence self-startler, Jim. Pickups of insight, he calls these moments. Whenever my boss is struck dumb by his own epiphanic inner light, I picture a tiny deer jolted out of its grazing with grass in its mouth, paralyzed by the brilliant approach of a Mack truck. Wait a second, Rudy, why the hell do we call it that, awake, for a dead gal? Well, that's terrible. That's goddamn macabre. I have wondered that myself. Seems a pretty grim joke. Oh, there's definitely a reason, says the brown-nosing intern. Some Catholic logic. Or perhaps it's a Jews thing. People respond, bellows Rudy. Edgewater, she's an engine. Even our most resistant demographics will give to her. Males. Retirees. Greenwich bankers, West Texas construction workers, the Southeast Asian community where, as you well know, there is a culturally rooted suspicion of sleep donation. Of course, the intern nods, but they have no immunity to Edgewater's story. I am hovering near the trailer door, holding my breath. They keep talking and I listen. I desperately need what they are offering. A faith transfusion. The why and the how of our organization, our work and its value. In high school, the Red Cross blood truck would pull up behind the trailers to collect donations from young, hale students who got to skip homeroom and eat a raisin cookie and relinquish pints of typo. Dory gave, but I never did. I convinced myself that I was scared of needles. If I'd known then that I'd wind up here begging strangers for an hour of their sleep, I believe I would have given blood at every opportunity. As a Corps volunteer, my duties are numerous and varied. Weekends, I mobilize the sleep van, a moonlit enterprise that dispatches a volunteer team to the homes of good sleepers who have signed up to donate their rest to insomniacs. A sleep van has a Spartan interior, the beds we call catch cots. If the van is equipped for infants and children, it features catch cribs and trundles. Nurses slip on the anesthetic mask, open the IV of special chemicals, relieving a donor of consciousness. Next, they clamp on and adjust the silver helmet, which does chafe a bit. 1 to 2 minutes after the loss of consciousness, once the donor enters a state of artificially stimulated sleep, the draw commences. Then the air in the sleep van turns balmy as the tubing heats. A donor's green moist breath gets siphoned into nozzles that connect to our tanks. Healthy sleep is pumped out of the body in long, clear tubes. Weeknights, I recruit. We set up sleep drives in neighborhoods all across the country right at sundown. Nurses swab out helmets in multiple vans, preparing to take sleep donations for testing. Administrators sit inside lit tents on suburban lawns, holding clipboards, pre-screening donors with an eligibility questionnaire to filter out those whose sleep is prone to nightmares, disturbance. We babble the questions to volunteers underneath the midnight pines. When was your last full night of deep, unbroken sleep, ma'am? When did you last dream about barking dogs, outer space, red grass, an ex-wife? Now please be honest, sir. If your sleep was disturbed by her face, check the box. For most of the 21st century, insomnia was treatable by prescription medications. I can still remember going with my father to pick up my sister's sleeping tablets from the owl-faced pharmacist, capsules of Silanor, half white and half carnation pink. My sister's sleep trouble began early at age 11. Back then, before the disease progressed, medications reliably rolled her under. I used to steady her face on the pillow, trying to catch the moment when the drugs took effect. Once her adolescent insomnia ratcheted up for unknown reasons into the full-blown disorder, Joy slept about 4 hours a night. For years, this was enough. The body can be a marvel of resiliency, a cactus when it comes to sleep, capable of surviving on mere drops. By 20, however, Dory had developed a resistance to all sleep aids. She also became quite suddenly impossible to anesthetize. We learned this when she broke her leg in college and surgeons were forced to operate on a fully conscious Dory. The anesthesiologist was still writing papers about her. Her leg healed, but soon Dory lost the ability to sleep even 3 hours a night. She could not stay down long enough to cycle into REM. She dropped out of college and moved into a white hospital room. What didn't they try on her? Here come a bunch of drugs I can't actually pronounce. Dexmedetomidine, propofol, sevoflurane, xenon. The trank gun used to bring down zoo elephants would have stopped her heart, or I'm sure they would have given that a go. Nobody could shave or muzzle my sister's mind. For the next year and 7 months, Dory barely slept. Then the loss became total. The final day of my sister's life unwound with zero regard for the moon or the sun. She died awake after 20 days without sleep, locked flightlessly inside her skull. As an adolescent, I used to seethe with jealousy because whereas I got auburn stubs, Dory had these fringed butterfly eyes, jet lashes that curled so outrageously around her green irises that strangers assumed they were drugstore falsies. During her endless last day, I remember studying those eyelashes pasted to her skin at an angle of unrelieved attention. She blinked at me, her thinking slow as syrup, and I wished that she would not smile again, not ever again, not like that, because by that point, every smile was an accident, a twitch driven by nothing that I recognized as human. My mouthy, gorgeous, stupid, brave sister, Dory, misdrive it like you stole it, even when the only it available to us was our great aunt's haunted house of a wood-paneled Chrysler. Who ever heard of a car with termites? Miss three jobs, two college majors, and there's a flask in my purse, was at this point a nobody. A vegetable, as they say, the doctor's potted plant. And I hated the sight of her facial muscles pumpkin grinning on the pillow, her pale eyes twitching, and I hated watching her go speechless under the conglomerate weight of so much unrelenting looking and thinking and listening and feeling. Her mind worn thin by the sound of every cough and the plinking moisture of every raindrop. These noises exploding like grenades through her naked awareness, her mind crushed in the end by an avalanche of waking moments. Once sleep stopped melting time for Dory, she could not dig herself out. She was buried under snowflakes, minutes to hours to months. The official cause of death was organ failure. I know it doesn't sound like much on paper. The same month Dory died, the CDC released the first case definition of the new terminal insomnia. Early estimates suggested that several hundred people in the U.S. were suffering from total sleep loss. 1 year after my sister's funeral, this number had swelled to 20,000. Orexins, the media taught us to call them, so that almost immediately the disorder became a metonym for its chosen victims. George Washington University Hospital opened the first dedicated critical care insomnia ward. It was full within days. Congress allocated $2 billion for research. In the months following the CDC release, many people dismissed the disorder as an exaggeration of a universal American condition. Who was sleeping enough? Nobody. The crisis sounded like more TV hyperbole designed to keep us glued to our screen watching mattress commercials. America, in the childhood of our understanding of the crisis, called its first victims liars, hypochondriacs, wackos, crank addicts, insurance defrauders, anxious plagiarists of real biological disorders. What triggers the dysfunction in some brains as opposed to others? Do these people have some inherited anomaly, some predisposition to wakefulness, a higher wattage consciousness, or is the trigger environmental? That's the $2 billion question. To date, every known case has occurred in the Americas, and nobody knows why this should be so either. Some speculate that this sickness is connected to the ocean's tides, magnetism, the poles, the hemispheres, the net of light and shadow on the globe. Other pundits promise, with weird relish, that we are seeing the end of sleep as we know it. TV has become a glum hall of prophets. Dr. Devisha Frank from the Boston Sleep Tank, who speaks like a robot programmed to self-destruct. Dour professors wearing sunflower yellow ties that film well. According to these professional Cassandras, sleep has been chased off the globe by a 24-hour news cycle, our polluted skies and crops and waterways, the bald eyeballs of our glowing devices. We Americans are sitting in an electric chair that we engineered, they say. What becomes of our rhythms, the old glad harmonies that leapt through us like the vascular thrust of water through leaves of grass? Bummer news, Walt, that song's done. And the endogenous clock, the suprachiasmatic nucleus, hereditary prize of every human, that tiny star cluster of neurons in the hypothalamus, which regulates our yawning appetites for hard winter light and spacey blackness, the master clock that syncs us to one another and to the Earth's rotation, the sun, the moon, to all the kingdoms on the 24-hour circuit, bacteria, Gila monsters, great sequoias, blue whales, orange groves, bear cubs, mustangs, toadstools, leopards, golden eagles, hyacinths, hippopotami, those tiny wizards, the butterflies, those glue artists, the arachnids, and all the sequined life on the seafloor, the urchins that improbably still clock time with us. Bummer news, everyone. The clock stops for humanity. Time itself will soon become an anachronism. Time, as our species has lived it on this planet, will cease to exist. No more dark light binary, no more active red daytime, blue evening dissolving. No longer is sunshine the coagulant of consciousness, causing us to clot into personalities and cohere once more on our pillows each morning. These TV scientists predict a global desertification of dreams. Soon they promise the disruption will afflict all of us. Sleep will go extinct. And eventually, unless we can find some way to synthesize it, so will we. Generally, I'm mistrustful of these warblers who do the dread crescendo. But I'm embarrassed to report that the Slumber Corps has borrowed a page from their playbook. At sleep drives in Alabama, Georgia, and Florida, we are test screening a documentary created by those rating whores, the worst of the cable news fear lords. Is sleep going extinct? I am afraid to say it's been very effective. We show it at night like a popcorn horror flick. Terror, we've discovered, is a powerful donation stimulant. I'm just going to jump and read one tiny scene where there is an actual sleep donation. So she goes, she's getting sleep from babies. The Supreme Court rules that babies can be donors. Because what have they ever done for us, really? They're just takers. So in this universe, just kind of like hanging out. I mean, just really just taking. So we fix that in this world. After the first draw, we drive to the other side of town to get a draw from Roberta Frias. Roberta is six and such a funny kid, chatty until the very second before the anesthetic crests and rolls her under. She's no baby A, but her sleep is remarkably limpid, a reliable match for many insomniacs. EEGs of her first draw dazzled the nurses. Beautiful NREM, slow wave delta sleep, the state in which a body is repairing tissue, building bone and muscle, strengthening its immune system. On the couch cot, underneath the clear mask, her smile flutters and disappears. Her mother always dresses Roberta up for a donation, and the nurses have given up on telling her that this is unnecessary. Tonight, she's wearing a frilly yellow dress covered in tiny gray mice and a pink hairband. Her parents are watching from the corner of the sleep van, nervous and proud. Mr. Frias, a chubby Puerto Rican pastor, taxi driver, and very nervous father, a lip biter, gives me the thumbs up when our eyes meet. I don't know how to describe the unique claustrophobia of a sleep draw if you've never been present for one, except to compare it to the electric, heavy feeling of air carrying seawater. A frightening, exhilarating charge permeates the entire atmosphere of the sleep van, an overpowering sense of ambient destiny, fate crushing in on all sides. This accompanied by a nostril-flaring, neck-prickling vertigo. What provokes this disorientation, says Dr. Peebles, is your body's awareness of its proximity to an enveloping illusion, a dream, not your own, pumping out of the donor's form. The unhosted ghosts of these dreams in transit, en route to facilities where they will be tested, processed, plated on ice, awaiting transfusion. World blueprints. Roberta, according to our monitors, is discharging a shocking quantity of dreams. They go soaking out of her mouth and snaking through the breathing tubes, a galaxy per millisecond. The nurses claim not to notice the smell anymore. A clay odor you can almost taste, which reminds me of the white frogs we used to net from midnight ponds to scooped and dripping lilies. Minutes 4 through 8, as the coils begin to heat, the child's fantasy is in the room with us, unexpressed in any consciousness. Her dreams glug out of her. At the end of the draw, the machinery makes a fantastic chortle, a sort of mechanical blur. I don't have a deep enough voice. It's really scary for me. And one nurse, Louisa, who is very uncomfortable with child donation, giggles hysterically and says, "Pardon me." So I'm actually going to stop there at that unsatisfying plateau and read a little bit. No, just a tiny, tiny bit, and then I'll take questions. But that's sleep donation. That's how I imagine it going down. There's just a little bit of a hiccup. They discover a universal donor, this little girl, baby A. Her dreams are a match with every insomniac. Causes some trouble in the world of that story. I had this story collection come out just last year. This is a DJ request. I'll just read just the very beginning of this one. It's another story where there are sisters and, like, tragedy. My real-life sister, Lauren, when this novella came out, sent me a four-line email that said, "Dear sister, please stop writing about dead sisters. Love, your sister." It is a P.S. It is getting weird now. She's not the boss of me. just a really little bit from the beginning. It's just reeling for the empire. I always do a big wind-up for this story. I hope you don't need it. You shouldn't need to do a big wind-up for the beginning of a story, but it's just, I got really interested, like a dork, in the Meiji era of Japan. It's this time of incredible metamorphosis, this really violent transition from sort of the sleepy feudal island to they're wrenched into commerce with the West. They industrialize really rapidly. And these women, the true kind of historical origins for the story is these factory women. They're leaving their sort of like rural villages and towns to go work in these textile mills that wind up. They're sort of promised one kind of imperial vocation, and when they get there, the reality is quite different. And this is often cited as sort of the rise of feminist consciousness in Japan, because there are these collective, all kinds of labor strikes, all female labor strikes that start to happen in these textile mills. Several of us claim to have been the daughters of samurai, but of course, there's no way for anyone to verify that now. It's a relief in its way, the new anonymity. We come here tall and thin, noble women from Yamaguchi, graceful as calligraphy, and short and poor, Hita girls with bloody feet, crow-voiced and vulgar, entrusted to the model mill by our teary mothers, rented out by destitute uncles. But within a day or two, the recruitment agent begins to take effect. And the more our silkworm bodies begin to resemble one another, the more frantically each factory girl works to reinvent her past. One of the consequences of our captivity here in Nowhere Mill, and of the darkness that pools on the factory floor, and of the polar fur that covers our faces, blanking us all into sisters, is that anybody can be anyone she likes in the past. Some of our lies are quite bold. Yuna says that her great-uncle had a scrap of sailcloth from the black ships. Dai claims that she knelt alongside her samurai father at the Battle of Shirayama, bless you. Nishi fibs that she once stowed away in the imperial caboose from Shinbashi Station to Yokohama, and she saw Emperor Meiji himself eating pink cake. Back in Gifu, I had tangly hair like a donkey's tail, a mouth like a small red bean. But I tell the others that I was very beautiful. Where are you from, they asked me. I am from the castle in Gifu. Perhaps you know it from the famous woodblocks. My great-grandfather was a warrior. Oh, but Kitsune, we thought you said your father was the one who printed the woodblocks. Remember the famous ukiyo-e artist, Utagawa Kuniyoshi? Yes, she was, yesterday. I'll put it bluntly, we are all becoming reelers. Some kind of hybrid creature, part kaiko, silkworm caterpillar, and part human female. Some of the older workers' faces are already quite covered with a coarse white fur, but my face and thighs stayed smooth for 20 days. In fact, I've only just begun to grow the white hair on my belly. During my nights and days in the silk reeling factory, I was always shaking. I have never been a hysterical person. So at first, I misread these tremors as mere mood. I was in the clutches of a giddy sort of terror, I thought. Then the roiling feeling became solid. It was the thread, a color curling invisibly in my belly. It was silk. Yards and yards of thin color would soon be extracted from me by the machine. Today the agent drops off two new recruits, sisters from the Yamagata Prefecture, a blue village called Sakigawa, which none of us have visited. They are the daughters of a salmon fisherman, and their names are Tuka and Atsuya. They are 12 and 19. Tuka has waist-length braids and baby fat. Atsuya looks like a forest doe with a long neck and watchful brown eyes. When we step into the light, Atsuya swallows her scream. Tuka starts wailing, "Who are you? What has happened to you? What is this place?" That crosses the room to them, and despite their terror, the sisters are too sleepy and too shocked to recoil from Dai's embrace. They appear to have drunk the tea very recently because they're quaking on their feet. But Suyo's eyes cross, as if she's about to faint. Dai enrolls two tatami mats in a dark corner, helps them to stretch out. "Hey, sleep a little," she whispers, "try to dream." "Is this the silk reeling factory?" says Tuka, half-conscious on her bedroll. "Oh, yes," says Dai. Her furry face hovers like a moon above them. Then Tuka nods, satisfied, as if willing to dismiss all of her terror, to continue believing in the agent's promises, and shuts her eyes. Sometimes when the new recruits confide the hopes that brought them to our factory, I have to suppress a bitter laugh. Long before the Kaiko change turned us into mirror images of one another, we were sisters already, spinning identical dreams in beds thousands of miles apart, fantasizing about gold silks and an imperial vocation. We envisioned our future dowries, our family's miraculous freedom from debt. We thrilled to the same tales of women working in the grand textile mills, where steel machines from Europe gleamed in the light of the Meiji sunrise. Our world had changed so rapidly in the wake of the black ships that the poets could barely keep pace with the scenes outside their own windows. Since my arrival here, my own fantasies have grown as dark as this room. In them, I snip a new girl's thread midair, or I yank all the silk out of her at once so that she falls lifelessly forward. I haven't been able to cry since my first night here, but often I feel water pushing at my skull. "Can the thread migrate to your brain?" I've asked Dai nervously, because silk starts as a liquid. Right now, I can feel it traveling below my navel, my thread, foaming icily along the lining of my stomach. Under the blankets, I watch it rise in a hard lump. There are 20 workers sleeping on 12 tatami, two rows of us, our heads 10 centimeters apart, our earlobes curled like snails on adjacent leaves. And although we are always hungry, every one of us has a round belly. Most nights, I can barely sleep, moaning for dawn and the machine. Every aspect of our new lives, from working to sleeping, eating and shitting, bathing when we can get wastewater from the machine, is conducted in one brick room. The far wall has a single oval window set high in its center, too high for us to see anything besides scraps of cloud and a woodpecker that is like a celebrity to us, provoking gasps and applause every time he appears. Kaiko Joko, we call ourselves, silkworm workers. Unlike regular Joko, we have no foreman or men. We are all alone in the box of this room. Dai says that she's the dormitory supervisor, but that's just Dai's game. We were all brought here by the same man, the factory recruitment agent. We were all told slightly different versions of the same story. The recruitment agent travels the countryside to recruit female workers willing to travel far from their homes to a European-style mill. Presumably, he is out recruiting now. He makes his pitch not to the woman herself, but to her father or guardian, or in some few cases where single women can't be procured, her husband. "I am here on behalf of the nation," he says. "In the spirit of Shakusen Kyogyo, increase production, encourage industry. We are recruiting only the most skillful and loyal mill workers, not just peasant girls like your offspring, but the well-bred daughters of noblemen, samurai, aristocrats. City-born governors have begged me to train their daughters on the Western technologies. Last week, the medical general of the Imperial Army sent his 19-year-old twins by train. Sometimes there is resistance from the father or the guardian, especially among the Hicks, those stony-faced men from distant centuries who still make bean paste, wade into rice paddies, brew sake using thousand-year-old methods, but the agent waves all qualms away. Oh, you've heard about X Mill or Y Factory? No, the French engineers don't drink girls' blood. Haha, this is what we call red wine. Yes, there was a fire at Aichi Factory, a little trouble with tuberculosis in Suwa. But our factory is quite different. It's a national secret. It's a place that makes even the French filature in Gunma, with its brick walls and steam engines, look antiquated. This phantom factory he'll present with great cheerfulness and urgency because he says we've awoken to dawn, the enlightened era, and we must all play our role now. Japan Silk is her world expert. The blight has killed every silkworm in Europe, forever halted the Westerners' cocoon production. So the demand is as vast as the ocean, and this is the moment to seize. Silk reeling is a sacred vocation, and she will be reeling for the empire. The fathers and guardians nearly always sign the contract. Publicly, the Jocose family will share a cup of hot tea with the agent. They celebrate her new career and the 5 yen advance against her mortgaged future. Privately, an hour or so later, the agent will share a special toast with the girl herself. The agent improvises his tea rooms, an attic in a forest inn, or a locked changing room in a bathhouse, or, in the case of my sister, an abandoned cowshed. After sunset, the old blind woman arrives, the zookeeper we call her. She hauls our food to the grated door and bars the lower panel, and we pass her that day's quantity of reeled skill. She pushes back 2 sacks of mulberry leaves through the panel with a long stick. The zookeeper never speaks to us, no matter what questions we shout. She simply waits very patiently for our reeled silk, and so long as it's acceptable in quality and weight, she slides in the leaves. Tonight, she also slides in a tray of steaming human food for the new recruits. Tuka and Atsuyo get cups of rice and miso soup with floating carrots. Hunks of real ginger are unraveling in the broth like hair. We all sit on the opposite side of the room, and we watch them chew with a dewy nostalgia that disgusts me, even as I find myself ogling their long, white fingers on the chopsticks, the balls of rice. The salt and fat smells of their food makes my eyes ache. When we eat the mulberry leaves, we lower our new faces to the floor. They drink down the soup in silence. "Are we dreaming?" I hear one whisper. "The tea drugged us!" The younger sister, Tuka, cries at last. Her gaze darts here and there, as if she's really hoping to be contradicted. They traveled 9 days by riverboat and oxcart, Atsuyo tells us, wearing blindfolds the entire time, so we could be that far north of Yamagata or west, or east, the younger sister says. We collect facts from every new recruit, and we use them to draw thread maps of Japan on the factory floor. But not even Suki the Apt can guess our whereabouts. Nowhere Mill is what we call this place.
You've been listening to the Missouri Review Sound Booth podcast, music by Mark Catalano. log on to the Missouri Review's website to enter our 7th annual audio contest in the categories of poetry, prose, and audio documentary. Submissions are open until March 15th.